a whole pail of water just to cool him down.
Fire, fire on the mountain.
Hello, Mr. and Mrs. Radio Land. I am Eldridge Cleaver, the former Minister of Information of the Black Panther Party. You are listening to KBOO Portland. This is listener-sponsored, non-commercial community radio. I want you to listen to and support KBOO because Portland needs it, you need it, and the world needs it. Ubalagani, boing, boing.
KBOO Community Radio is requesting proposals for a grant writer to provide ongoing grant writing services and application support. This is a one-year contract position for 200 hours, compensated at $25 an hour. Proposals must be submitted electronically to Delphine Crescenzo, station manager at Del, that's D-E-L, at kboo.fm. Proposals are due Friday, January 4th at 5 p.m. Responsibilities, background information, the scope of work, and proposal requirements can be found at kboo.fm/grantwriter2018.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor a screening of the film From Shock to Awe, A Journey of Hope and Transformation on Thursday, January 10th at 7 p.m. at Regal Cinemas, Pioneer Place in Portland. The film hosts the path of two combat veterans from the Iraq War as they live with post-traumatic stress, the lack of effective treatment, and their search for healing. This is a crowdsourced event and tickets are currently available for purchase. There will be a brief Q&A following the film. Again, that's a screening of the film From Shock to Awe, A Journey of Hope and Transformation on Thursday, January 10th at 7 p.m. at Regal Cinemas, Pioneer Place, 340 Southwest Morrison Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Only four or five people lifted as popular civil rights movement leaders or co-workers with Dr. King, for example. Most people think that Jesse and Andrew Young and Fannie Lou Hamer and Rosa Parks, those are the folks who made the movement. Now, I love every one of those folks, so don't get me wrong, but I tell you, it does a disservice to that great historical event. We ought to lift up the names of medical doctors who gave leadership, mothers and wives who raised the children, often alone, freeing husbands to be on the front lines, along with the women who were also on the front line, registering people to vote, making the meals, encouraging people to get involved, organizing projects in communities, teaching things that people needed to learn.
That was civil rights activist Dorothy Cotton, who passed away in June 2018. As Cotton noted, we often put the spotlight on the big names, but there were thousands of organizers, activists, and local social justice leaders around the world who died this past year. I'm Andrew Stelzer, and this week on Making Contact, as we do every December, we bring you some of the voices and stories of our fallen heroes.
My name is Karen Ishizuka, and I'm the chief curator at the Japanese American National Museum. I first met Aiko Herzig Yoshinaga when she was Aiko Abe, actually, in 1972. Aiko was in camp and was a single mother right after camp. So it started with, you know, a very personal endeavor to find out more about the incarceration. She was just very tenacious in her wanting to get to the bottom of this.
To be yelled at when you're walking in the streets, go back to where you came from, you know, you're like gooks, and just hateful things. It was just very hard for me to take.
She decided to go and just do some personal research at the National Archives regarding her own family. So one thing led to another, and she ended up just accumulating so much information. The government's final report, as they called it, of the incarceration that was written in 1943 was actually not the original, but a cleaned up version. There were 10 copies that were made, and they were deliberately destroyed by the U.S. government because they revealed too much of why the incarceration really was not a military necessity, but really based on some racist assumptions of Japanese Americans. So 9 of the 10 copies of that original final report had been deliberately destroyed by the U.S. government. She really, against all odds, ended up finding the 10th copy that no one knew even existed.
I took it upon myself to do what some people call unnecessary extra work, but I documented everything I got exactly where I found it. What file, what box, what record group, and everything else, so that people couldn't say, how can that be? Here is proof, officially written by top government. Here's proof.
The legal implications of her findings are really historic. They were really critical for the Commission on Wartime Relocation and Internment of Civilians. The commission's conclusion, in turn, laid the groundwork for the passage of the Civil Liberties Act of 1988. Which provided an apology from the U.S. government as well as monetary compensation to surviving inmates.
Yes, we got an apology, a letter of apology from Bush and Clinton, and $20,000 per survivor. But we didn't make a dent. We didn't affect how this country was looking at Arab Americans after 9/11. I don't think it's really possible, but I really would like to see an international tribunal charging the United States for not living up to its democratic principles, not just 9/11 and the aftermath of Guantanamo, but going back to our situation.
Aiko was one of a couple of other Nisei women who really have shown not only Japanese America and Asian America, but the world that just plain people, and women in particular, can make such a difference.
My name is Kim Duncan. I am the older sister of Muhyiddin Moyet. Some people know him by Muhyiddin de Baha. He, you know, always had a tie to the community, always had a tie to the kids, always had a tie to education. But I think what really sparked things was the shooting of Walter Scott, which happened in 2015. You know, Walter Scott was a black man killed by a police officer in North Charleston, South Carolina. And the person who recorded that shooting gave the video to Muhyiddin, and that's when it all started, I think, for him.
The capitalist that started this whole experiment of American slavery, you know, the police have always done their bidding. And so this is not a new thing, and it's an old story, and it's such an old story that when we don't tell it all the way from the time before we got to these shores, then we miss out on important knowledge like the 13th Amendment.
He also did stuff like jump and take down the Confederate flag from someone at a rally.
Oh, you can see what's happening right now. It looks like both sides of the crowd are fighting one another.
While this happened on live television, a protester in Charleston, South Carolina, jumped a barricade and then tried to snatch a man's Confederate flag. The man arrested for taking that flag is the leader of Black Lives Matter in Charleston.
He had helped or accommodated Bree Newsom, was the young woman who took the flag down in Columbia, which is, you know, our capital here in South Carolina. She actually climbed up the flagpole and removed the flag, you know, which has started this whole protest thing about the flag.
When we talk about the flag, we don't get into agitation of race. We get into talks about abolition and states' rights. We talk about the reality of it. This country is founded upon economic capital developed from free and cheap labor. Now that that cheap labor is not used because of technological innovation, we have the prison industrial complex and other ways to subsidize people's living and housing. Again, the impact on the community has not changed. It's still the same exact story.
He created a educational piece, which is called Building from the Block Up, which is basically, you know, starting on the block with the young kids and impressing upon them the importance of education and just community and voting and socialization, exposing them to things that they may not get in their household, teaching them about racism and police and what's happening and what you can do about it and those type of things.
We have to be able to take a political stance and say, we want to control what happens in our community. Not only the law enforcement, we want to control what happens in our schools. We want to control the way that our property taxes are divvied out. We want to control who's moving in our community, at what rate, what businesses are moving in our community, what benefit are they having, right? So it's a change of our character in the way that we interact with the system. That's what the movement represents. That's what this generation represents. We don't know and we don't believe that incremental reforms are going to work. We don't believe that everything's going to be better if we vote the right person in the office. We understand that the system has been designed in order to keep things the way they are.
You know, the Black Lives Matter here chapter closed here because there's no one to lead it and carry it on. But other people have stepped up and is it as organized and as one when Muhyiddin was here? No, because he had a knack for being able to get people, all different kinds of people, in a room and listen and talk and do. So I think it's going to be difficult. I do think he's made a change. I just hope Charleston doesn't forget what he started.
My name is Aline Andrade. I'm a lawyer and a human rights activist in Brazil. I'm a member of the Black feminist movement in Brazil since I'm 16 years old. So I met Marielle Franco because she was also a human rights activist in Brazil, and she was talking about women rights, LGBTQ rights in Brazil, and she was also a councilwoman, very famous, like among the Black movements in Brazil.
I campaigned to defend and help the public. For example, I campaigned to help the Black woman in the favela and all that comes with it. I campaigned for the Black lesbian women in the favela. I campaigned for the Black mother in the favela. And I campaigned for the single Black woman in the favela.
So she was a single mother, very young, poor people, like, and she grew up in a favela in Brazil, and she became a councilwoman. So she has this really very unique, not only because she was Black and poor, but because she was fighting for women's rights, and she really deeply understands the meaning of intersectionality for women's rights. So she was not fighting about class or about race or about gender. She put everything together and was really fighting to improve life of common people in Brazil, to have wealth distribution and education for all in Brazil, especially in Rio, the place she was from.
Favelas are like plots of land that are used by the person in charge, how he sees fit. The people in charge use the favelas, but they don't try to resolve its social demands. The people in the favelas usually don't vote for their politicians. They don't vote for the children in office that just work to help themselves. But this is slowly changing. We are slowly increasing the number of voters in the favela.
Mas a gente cresceu a votação na favela.
Marielle Franco was murdered this year on March 2018. And Franco's death came weeks after she denounced police violence in Brazil. Someone was following Marielle Franco. She was shot 4 times in the head at close range. It was not a mistake. She was not in the middle of a war. She was a human rights defendant who was killed because she was defending human rights. people went to streets to protest against her death, to ask for police working on her death, knowing who killed her, trying to fight for justice. Brazil is already submerged in a sea of hatred and hopelessness. And we are watching the raise of voice against democracy, human rights, and anti-racist movement. That is a reality that now we must deal with. And I believe that if she was there with us, here with us, she would be fighting for economic, social, racial, equality, and for diversity, because that's what she was doing.
You're listening to Making Contact. This week, we're hearing the voices and stories of some of the lesser-known social justice leaders who passed away in 2018. If you're interested in learning more about these people or want to support our show, which is provided free to radio stations all over the world, please visit radioproject.org.
My name is Anise Parker. I am the former mayor of the city of Houston and the current president and CEO of the LGBTQ Victory Fund and Victory Institute. I knew Ray Hill for more than 40 years. He was an LGBT activist before any of us knew there was such a thing as an LGBT movement.
I have been in this struggle since I came out of the closet in 1958. There's not many people here that were alive in 1958. Of course, nobody made fun of me because I was also the quarterback of the football team and the biggest, meanest guy. So those people are still confused at whether I'm the embarrassing queer or the football hero they wish they had back. But it was a struggle then, and I hate to tell you, it is a struggle now.
So Ray had three big passions. One was the LGBT community and movement. The other was prisoners' rights and prison reform. And the third was Free Speech Radio and KPFT, which is the Pacifica station in Houston. And into all three of those major areas of activism, he wove his passion for the First Amendment. Folks would get out of prison. They'd look him up through the prison show. He'd invite them on to talk about their experiences. Over time, he created a cadre of programmers who were all ex-cons, but it gave them a new outlet and a sense of purpose.
There's no doubt in my mind that the world is rational enough to ultimately award those who are struggling for an end to the drug war. I think your farthest goal will ultimately be achieved. Why? I'm a teetotaler. I mean, I've got 55 years of being completely drug and alcohol free. So I have a very objective look at all of this. I look at it from what it's doing to criminal justice, what it's doing to families, what it's doing to like human life in general. And the problem has never been the drugs. The problem has always been the war on the drugs.
In, I believe, 1977, this was the era of Anita Bryant as she was attacking the community. And Ray helped organize a protest against the appearance of Anita Bryant. And it was the first public protest by the LGBT community. And it was expected to be a small sort of ho-hum, you know, 20 people marching around in a circle outside the hotel in downtown Houston. And instead, hundreds and hundreds of us poured into the streets and, in fact, took back the streets. And I would say that that night when we stepped off on the march against Anita Bryant, we were a frustrated, sort of disorganized rabble. And by the time we ended that march, we were the Houston movement for LGBT equality.
Right here, right now, today, I want you in your own mind and out loud if you want to, I declare my equality. Can I hear it?
I declare my equality.
Well, you own it. Now it's up to some other sucker to come take it away from you. And you should defend that with all of the vigor that you have. Don't ever give up. All we have to do is politically outlive the suckers.
On Ray Hill's tombstone, his epitaph, as it were, is a citation for his win at the United States Supreme Court, Houston versus Hill. He interrupted a police officer who was harassing an LGBT member of the community, and the police officer promptly arrested Ray. And Ray established, for good and for all, that if you're not interfering with a police officer and placing that officer in danger, you can insult a police officer, you can speak to a police officer and engage with them, and that's not illegal. He was never ashamed of who he was. He was comfortable in his own skin in a way that even a lot of young activists you see now who didn't have to experience the things that we older activists did could never achieve. He was who he was, and he didn't care what you thought of him.
My name is Samu, and I'm working with Korean Environment and Social Action Network based in Thai-Burma border. So let me tell you the story about Saw Mu. He's a Korean indigenous right defender. Saw Mu worked tirelessly to protect some of the last intact old-growth forests and endangered species habitats remaining in Burma.
Local people here highly value wildlife. Our lives and animals are equal. There is no difference. We all have flesh and blood. The wildlife species that we prohibit from hunting in our area include hulak gibbons, hornbills, Indian bison, tiger, tortoise, and parrots because they are becoming critically endangered.
And he was also one of the most active local community leader in Selwi Peace Park. The Peace Park initiative is a bottom-up initiative that envisions to create a 5,400 square kilometer indigenous Korean-led sanctuary to promote environmental protections, wildlife conservation, culture preservations, and peace.
I can honestly say that for indigenous Karen peoples, this Salween Peace Park can fulfill our desires. It can help strengthen our traditions and culture, protect our lands and wildlife.
He is the community leader who helped his people who are hiding in the jungle. He also finds a way to get a food and like a humanitarian assistance for the villagers who are hiding. So on April 5th, 2018, he was shot and killed by the Burma army while he was on his way home from the community meeting because to organize aid for the newly displaced civilians. They killed him and then the government released the statement that they killed Saw Mu and they said he is the Korean soldier. Actually, he's not a soldier, he's a community leader.
I can sacrifice my life for others if I have to. There are real needs in the community, so we have to put all our efforts into the work. I am not working for personal benefit, nor expecting to receive any salary. In this struggle, we have to endure with others' criticisms. We have to devote our energies and our sweat. I could stay home and work on my own business, but there are people who still trust me, so I will continue to work for my people.
This is the big loss for us. He identified himself as an indigenous Korean person. He thought that as an indigenous people, he could have a Korean identity culturally and spiritually and by living a simple life.
Our actions not only benefit Karen people and the indigenous Karen communities. Our actions for forest and wildlife protection also have impacts on the world, which is affected by climate change and global warming. Our actions will also benefit the world because we don't engage in illegal wildlife trade. We don't do logging or sell forest resources.
We need more leaders like him. And we also want people around the world. We recognize his work as an indigenous leader.
My name is Billy X. Jennings. I'm here to talk about Sister Kilu Anasha. I knew her as Pat Galios, and our connection is through the Black Panther Party from the 1970s. I was in the Black Panther Party and worked at Century Headquarters, and she came into the party in New Haven. She was about 10 years older than most of the Panthers that were 18, 19, and 20. She already had a job. She was an independent liver. Charles Gary, the Black Panther Party attorney, came into town. He was looking for an assistant secretary, and she fit the bill. So she started working with Charles Gary to free Bobby Seale and Erica Huggins.
The counter-revolution was instituted big time. Their strategies and tactics against us were illegal. I myself was a plaintiff in a wiretap lawsuit that was settled out of court, and I wound up with about $16,000. I was wiretapped at home and in the office because my pad was a Panther pad, and the office was almost a second Panther headquarters, okay? So the bottom line is they attacked us unmercifully. They murdered us, jailed us on anything they could find. Some of us are still in jail. Plenty of us are still in jail, actually.
She was on the front lines on many issues, dealing with political prisoners, dealing with social justice issues. She had gotten her own radio show, and she then later on in life, she had a video show on the cable channel. Freedom is a Constant Struggle.
The name of my show is Freedom is a Constant Struggle. It focuses on the struggles in Haiti and Palestine, Venezuela, Nigeria, and other African and Latin American countries, and on U.S. wars. On the domestic front, it deals with education, health care, homelessness, mass incarceration, and political prisoners, as well as the ongoing fight for revolutionary change. And our viewers are encouraged to think globally and act locally.
She fought for Palestinian freedom and autonomy. She fought for women's liberation fight. She fought for Haiti, right? She was a champion of Haiti being independent and having the right to govern themselves. She was like an internationalist, in which she's saying was in the Black Panther Party, but more so now because she knew the key players. She could bring us relevant information around issues that concern us today. Or maybe we didn't even know about that particular issue going on, and she's, you know, enlightened us on the struggle, you know?
We have to just ignore the damn governments that are not serving the people and serve the people by their soul. Organize, organize, organize in our communities and take care of business. We can do this. We have to be bold, and we have to understand that this is a protracted struggle. And I'm almost 79. This year I'll be 79. I have to pass the torch. I have to pass it to you. I have to pass it on, you know, because I can't stay here long enough to see it happen. And, you know, we thought when we were Panthers and we were young, we thought we were going to see the change. But we're not. But the change will come if we keep fighting. If we never stop fighting, we'll get.
She was one of those people who was dedicated to the principles of the struggle, right? She was going to be a revolutionary till she died. She would always say, dare to struggle, dare to win.
And that's it for this edition of Making Contact. Our list of fallen heroes we wanted to honor was long, and we had to make some tough choices to put together this show. If there's an important activist or organizer you know who passed away in 2018, let us know on our Making Contact Facebook page. The Making Contact team is Executive Director Lisa Rudman, producers Anita Johnson, Monica Lopez, and Salima Hamarani, Audience Engagement Director Sabine Blazin, Outreach and Distribution Assistant Dylan Hoyer, and I'm Andrew Stelzer. Thanks for listening to Making Contact. We leave you now with the words of someone else who passed away this year, science fiction novelist Ursula Le Guin.
What does progress mean? The Latin word means going forward, right? Just going forward. Well, that's what you do when you walk, when you live. You just go forward. You can't help it. But progress towards what? And in what direction? I'm beginning to question the word progress. I think we sort of assume that it means progress towards something better, higher, nobler, more generous, more free. I don't know, but you can progress towards evil just as easy. Mm-hmm. It's the unheard voices that, if we're going to get anywhere, we really have to start listening to each other and to the voices that we have not listened to, because I have to say that this sort of the dominant European white imperial voice has got us where we are, and it's not a very good place to be right now.
Making contact.
Making contact.
This week on Making Contact.
Clearly, racism has devastating impacts on people of color, and I think it also has serious impacts on white people. One is that we're being exploited by the same ruling class that's exploiting people of color, and yet we're unable to work together across those differences because we've been trained to see people of color as dangerous, as outsiders. So we're very easily led to believe that recent immigrants or Muslims or people of color in our cities or Native Americans, whoever, are the enemy, are the ones who are, attacking us, when in fact it is a ruling class.
On this edition of Making Contact, we'll discuss opposing racism, white fragility, useful strategies, and practical tools for white individuals committed to racial justice. We'll speak with author Paul Kibble about his book, Uprooting Racism, How White People Can Work for Racial Justice. The book suggests ways for individuals and groups to challenge the structures of racism. First, Paul, let me welcome you to Making Contact. And your book, Uprooting Racism, was published in the 1990s. And many years later, the book still holds a particular relevance considering our existing political climate and the overt reemergence of white nationalist rhetoric. First in simplicity, but necessary in shaping today's conversation, how would you define racism?
I define racism as a system of domination, of wealth and power used by the ruling class to elevate white people, to give them benefits so that they'll buy into the system, accept the status quo, and that subordinates, exploits, and uses violence against people of color to maintain that. Mm-hmm. It operates, I think it's important to notice that it operates on several different levels. One is the interpersonal level, one is the institutional level. Mm-hmm. It operates on the structural level, the inner actions of all those institutions, and then also on the cultural level.
Well, let's be more specific. What would be some of the concrete material benefits that one may not immediately identify, but you would see as white folks in our society being classified would receive certain privileges based on their skin?
I think it's clear that as white people, we receive benefits such as better access to housing, better access to education, better access to health care. If you think about who makes your clothes, who makes your cell phone and computer, who grows the food that we eat, a lot of that is done by people of color in this country and overseas. And so both on the one hand, we benefit, and we are connected, we are interdependent with people of color, those of us who are white. And at the same time, we have to realize that most of the benefits from racism are accumulated at the top of the economic pyramid, so that the 1% or the 0.1% accumulates most of the wealth, most of the power and benefits. So it's true that all of us who are white benefit in some ways, and we're also exploited, and those benefits accrue to the top of the economic pyramid.
Now, there's a chapter in the book titled White Fragility and White Power. I think the power part is self-explanatory. People get it, right? However, define white fragility and how is it used to avoid dealing with racism, and how do those responses impact people of color?
White fragility is a term that Robin DiAngelo, I think, coined, and it describes the way that, you know, part of how whiteness is maintained and racism is maintained is through silence in white communities, mm-hmm. not talking about it, mm-hmm. and denying it, minimizing it. So when people of color raise the issue of racism, describing their experiences, white people have a range of different ways that they express their fragility around that, their inexperience, their lack of skill and practice at even talking about racism. Sometimes that looks like a direct aggression, shutting people down, denying their experience. Sometimes it looks like passivity, withdrawing. There's a lot of kind of range of ways, but all of those ways are ways to really counterattack, to shut down the discussion so that racism, the attention turns to the feelings of the white person rather than the actual experience of a person of color.
Right, right. I experienced that from good-meaning white folks.
Exactly. It has nothing to do with intention. It's about impact.
Right.
And as white people, we like to think we're good people. We have the best of intentions, but that doesn't mean that we're not colluding with and perpetrating racism in our daily interactions.
How can white folks, well-meaning white folks, check their privilege at the door, be it, you know, in a personal relationship, friendship that you may have with someone, but maybe also someone or a person of color, I should say, rather, but also in working environments? You know, I've had these various experiences where, you know, it's like you are not accepting no for an answer, or you're telling me, one instance in particular, I think she was well-meaning white woman, was like, I want to help you do your job, but she never thought to ask me what I thought was needed to help me do my job better. So it was automatically that she's working from a position that she already knew, even though she hadn't been here as long or the same amount of experience that I had. So it's like, how do you have them in the space? How are white people to check their privilege or their notions of superiority in the conversation around racism and moving forward and being more an advocate than anything else?
I think it's really important that as white people, we have to realize that we've been socialized into the system. We've been socialized into expectations of entitlement, of superiority. All the education and culture we've absorbed tells us the white people are superior, are in charge. They've been the heroes and builders and doers and creators in the world. Mm-hmm. And so if we just show up with all of that baggage, all of that misunderstanding, we're obviously going to just perpetrate more racism. We have to step back and do some personal work. We have to learn more about history. We have to learn more about what's going on. And particularly, we have to listen. We have to come in with a lot of humility, mm-hmm. Not expecting to have the answers, not expecting to be in charge, expecting to ask questions, to learn, to find a way to participate that doesn't perpetrate or recreate those same patterns of dominance that we're that are ingrained in us through our socialization.
Right. I mean, in many ways, in various situations, I've experienced microaggression. I think it's really interesting because I feel like people already know that people have a certain level of education and understanding, yet it's easier to do the opposite of what we know is right. One thing for me in particular, multiple times on this particular program, I've stated that privilege is an addiction. Be it privilege one receives from being white in America or male, do you see privilege as an addiction? What's your take on that?
I think it's an addiction, I would agree, in the way that it's rewarded constantly. You get hits of affirmation regularly. It's certainly a deep-seated habit of thought and behavior that's internalized into our emotional being and into our the way we think. So that's why I think we could use the terms such as white supremacy or white hegemony, or they're so deep-seated that we don't recognize it. And therefore, we need to be to realize that we need to look to people of color to and honor and credit their experience and their knowledge, because we are going to be the last to be able to notice that.
Yeah, I definitely think there's a re-education and unlearning process that one has to be willing to participate in and really do the work, because it would be like overcoming any addiction, you know? And you can have relapse, you know, at any given moment. So I think it's being more conscious and aware of your actions and how you exist in the society, especially when you're rewarded for a certain behavior. Moving forward, though, I wanted to kind of get your sense of what you see as the cost of racism as it relates to white people. We understand that the cost that it may have or impact that it may have on communities of color, black and brown communities and so forth. I kind of want to have you describe the cost that you see to white people regarding their own silence and complacency in existing in a racist society.
Clearly, racism has devastating impacts on people of color, and I think it also has serious impacts on white people. One is that I kind of obliquely referred to earlier, is that we're being exploited by the same ruling class that's exploiting people of color, and yet we're unable to work together across those differences because we've been trained to see people of color as dangerous, as outsiders. So we're very easily led to believe that recent immigrants or Muslims or people of color in our cities or Native Americans, whoever, are the enemy, are the ones who are, you know, attacking us, when in fact it is a ruling class. So one of the costs is that we're unable to work with our allies in changing, really transforming our society that serves to one that serves all of us. There's tremendous emotional costs. White people live very segregated lives in general. We're very isolated from communities of color. So we're cut off from the brilliance and the creativity of communities of color. We end up having a false sense of history, of our own histories, our family histories, our cultural history, because of the lies and misinformation we're fed. We're told that white people have done everything of significance and people of color are, you know, need us to save them. Also, I think there's deep psychic and spiritual cost to being in a society and living our lives dependent, interdependent with people of color, and our benefits coming at the exploitation of people of color. That has deep impact on our personal integrity. When we don't speak out and challenge the injustice that we're complicit with, then those are really serious wounds to our integrity, our soul, our spirituality.
Yeah, I definitely would agree with you on that. And I remember one of the first individuals, not the first, but someone who I remember being a guest on this program would be Dr. Joy DeGruy, and she talked a bit about the spiritual impacts of silence and the horrors that white people witnessed and almost, or not, well, not almost, but witnessed and embrace, such as lynchings, as if it was normal and something that folks did. And then pushing across that conversation, she was like, well, this is why folks can see, you know, Trayvon Martin being murdered and not see anything wrong with it, because there is a spiritual loss. You know, that's been the impact for white folks, which you would agree with that.
Absolutely. It destroys our compassion, our sense of empathy with other people. It sets up barriers between us and a lot of the world. And that has soul-destroying impact.
Mm-hmm.
You're listening to an interview with Paul Kivel, the author of Uprooting Racism, How White People Can Work for Racial Justice, and this is Making Contact. If today's conversation has provided you with food for thought, take a minute and subscribe to our podcast. Sign up for Making Contact updates. Take our survey or join the conversation on Facebook or Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. Now back to the conversation with Paul Kivel, discussing ways for individuals and groups to challenge the structures of racism. This is the fourth revised and updated edition of this book. So that means that there is still a need, right?
We're still there.
Now, what kind of feedback have you received privately from other white folks? Have any of them attempted to call you a race traitor? That how dare you, as a white man, even legitimize this conversation about racism?
That happens sometimes. I've received hate mail and things like that, comments in right-wing magazines and stuff like that. You know, it goes with the territory. Those aren't the people I'm talking to.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly, I think today, especially today, there's more and more white people who are aware we're in deep trouble, that racism is part of that deep trouble, and that they want to do something. And so they're very appreciative of a book like Uprooting Racism, which is really a toolbox of information and history and guidelines and questions and a lot of information that can help them get involved. Because there's a lot of personal work we need to do, but ultimately we need to get out into the community and be working for racial justice.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is the end goal of my work and what I think a lot of people want to be doing.
Where do we miss the mark? Where do we go wrong, especially when we think about the disconnect? Here we are with the 45th president being Donald Trump. Much of his rhetoric would embrace and uplift and support white supremacist thought. You have, in certain situations, good-meaning white folks that have supported him. Some folks are waking up now, but where did we go wrong in the larger conversation of addressing racism in our society to the point where we would actually elect someone like Donald Trump and even have white folks not see how detrimental he could be to their own existence and survival in this United States?
That's a good question. The president's support came, the majority of it came from fairly well-off white people, well-educated and well-off with higher average incomes than most white people. And clearly he lost the popular vote. I think that where we've gone wrong is to not acknowledge the history of and legacy of racism and the way that it permeates our society today. We've been reluctant to have those conversations, and our silence has been complicity with the status quo. And so after the civil rights movement, people could start talking about a post-racial society. And after Obama was elected, it kind of confirmed for many white people that, well, we're doing okay. And in polls, even in the last year or two, the majority of white respondents said racism wasn't a major problem in our country, and they said it wasn't in their community. So one thing is that we've often seen racism as something over there. I grew up in California. I thought racism in the 50s and 60s was only in the South. And, you know, we're always looking for it's not here, it's not me, it's not us, it's not now, it's historic, it's over there, it's other people. We have to say it is here. And I'm involved, and I need to do something, and we need to train and educate our young people to be able to recognize racism, to have the moral courage to stand up and intervene and get involved in racial justice work.
Now, you said a majority of white folks who are well off financially supported Trump, but I remember seeing in certain, you know, southern beds, poor white folks who said, yeah, I want to keep my job. I want to keep the job in the coal mine. And,
right. You
know, those folks also voted for him. But he, when you look at his platform then versus now, you know, we're talking about losing jobs. We're talking about losing health care that would also benefit those financially challenged white folks as well. What's your take on that?
I think that we have a long history of blaming other people, mm-hmm. scapegoating immigrants, people that African Americans and Mexican Americans, Latinx, a bunch of people that we could that the ruling class has directed our attention to and given us constant information about how dangerous they are and how they're taking our jobs. Mm-hmm. And so we haven't been doing the education and base building that we need to be doing to counter that and refocus the attention on the real power structures in our society, the billionaires who are making the decisions to ship jobs overseas, to strip our communities of resources, to privatize the education and healthcare and prison industrial systems. It's as white people collectively, we have a lot of work to do to catch up to the current reality. And the current reality is not new with this president. It's the longstanding patterns, and we've been
hoodwinked and bamboozled.
Exactly. And complacent because we've given some few benefits. Partly they're psychological benefits that were better than, at least we're not people of color. And then there's some tangible economic and material benefits that we can walk down the streets and not be stopped by police, that we can get into schools and get our children an education mm-hmm. that isn't available to people of color often.
Right. You know, a lot of our listeners, not all, but some of them would say that they identify with the hip-hop generation. They grew up in that particular era. One thing that I've heard people such as Russell Simmons say or Jay-Z is that hip-hop has done a lot to bring the races together. It's been, you know, they even has gone as far as saying that, you know, done more than the civil rights movement. I think that's debatable. But when you think about hip-hop and how you could have young white kids partying with young black kids and brown kids and Asian kids, there is a melting pot that exists, but it only exists within a small spectrum. Those white kids leave, they go off to college, and they forget about, there's that disconnect around, hey, my favorite hip-hop artist is a Wu-Tang Clan, but yet I can easily vote against something that may impact those young kids, you know, three strike laws and so on and so forth. Explain to me, if you're able to, how does that happen? Like, I'm just trying to understand, like, how do you embrace a particular culture and still, you know, and some of these kids are like my friends, right? And then we have to have these real conversations mm-hmm. where we challenge each other and these particular pathologies, because the thought is that Anita is different. Anita is not a criminal. But once I leave out of that circle, right, all the other white people view me as a criminal. And you have these same kids that say, well, Anita doesn't exist in that group of being quote unquote criminal, but they vote on legislation that would in turn criminalize me. It's like, you know, you have some of these same groups of white folks that would love Michael Jackson and Prince, but not see him as black. Mm-hmm. Help me understand that.
I think that's complex. There's a couple of different things I just mentioned briefly. One is that one of the ways that racism works is through cultural appropriation of the cultures and religions and music and art of communities of color. And, you know, hip-hop is often appropriated by young white people. You can take the culture and leave the people behind. And there's a lot of people who love jazz or rock and roll or hip hop or all kinds of manifestations of black culture, Native American culture, whatever. And that doesn't actually lead to understanding of institutional patterns of racism, nor a commitment to actually get involved in working for racial justice. The other part of thing that I would mention is that there's part of the way racism works is to allow white people to exoticize people of color and to eroticize them so that those cultures and those relationships become something you do because it's exotic, it's countercultural, it may be against the family norms or the community norms. And also that it's eroticized. It's enticing. It's tantalizing. And so a lot of young people, and of course this is marketed to them by white music executives, industry people who are making the decisions to market hip-hop music to white teenagers, right? So it's not even that people of color have control at the economic level of the industry. And it's very much exoticized and eroticized in youth, white youth culture.
Mm-hmm. Moving forward in the conversation of what an ally is, and this is also another chapter in your book, focusing on the hip-hop aspect for a minute, for the BET Awards, which is Black Entertainment. I don't know if Paul thought he was going to be participating in a hip-hop conversation to some extent.
That's fine. It's right there in the middle of it.
Okay, excellent. So BET, Black Entertainment Television, there was a cipher. Eminem was one who did a freestyle where he bashed Trump. Actually, right now, let's take a listen to the verse by Eminem that I'm referencing. And then once we come back, we'll discuss further.
That this is for Colin. Ball up a fist and keep that ish ball like Donald the sheep. He's going to get rid of all immigrants. He's going to build that thing up taller than this. Well, if he does build it, I hope it's rock solid with bricks. Because like him in politics, I'm using all of his tricks. Because I'm throwing that piece of this shit against the wall till it sticks. And any fan of mine who's a supporter of his, I'm drawing in the sand a line. You're either for or against. And if you can't decide who you like more in your split on who you should stand beside, I'll do it for you with this. You, the rest of America, stand up. We love our military and we love our country, but we hate Trump!
Again, that's Eminem at the BET Awards, his anti-Trump verse that he spat at the BET Awards. My question to you, Paul, is what's the role of an ally?
I think that for me, an ally is not an identity. It's a practice.
Yes.
It's what you do. It's how you show up. And it's not how you show up once in a while. It's how you show up every day. As white people, we have opportunities all the time in our families, neighborhoods, workplaces, communities to show up as an ally. It's great that people make statements, but especially if they have high profiles, but there's a whole lot more to do, and that has to be a regular effort. And that means addressing the institutional patterns in the music industry, if you're in hip-hop or another area like that, or in the other issues that are up in front of us in terms of policing and police violence and educational disparities and healthcare disparities and immigrant bashing. And there's just lots of ways. If you have a high profile, then you need to be working not only on the outside publicly, but on the inside of those institutions that you're part of to be building a different kind of structure there.
Absolutely. In your book, you provide useful strategies and practical tools for white people committed to racial justice. How can white people work towards and for justice?
I think there's so many ways because, you know, we have different positions, skills, experience. The first thing is to educate ourselves. The second thing is to break the silence and start talking about racism with our white communities. The third thing is to leverage our resources. We have time and money and access to institutions and access to white people and white youth and all kinds of ways that we actually you can turn our benefits into resources in service of racial justice. And then the final thing is really to pay attention to what people of color are saying and what they're doing, especially those who are on the front lines of grassroots struggle, because that's where the work needs to be in supporting those efforts, which are leading the way towards a real transformation of our society.
And that wraps it up for us today here on Making Contact. Special thanks to Paul Kibble, the author of Uprooting Racism, How White People Can Work for Racial Justice. To learn more about Paul Kibble or Making Contact, check out our website at radioproject.org. We'd like to know your thoughts about today's program. You can share your thoughts or provide us feedback about today's show by logging onto our homepage. That's radioproject.org. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast. Sign up for Making Contact updates, take our survey, or join the conversation on Facebook or Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. It would be great to hear from you. The Making Contact team is Lisa Rudman, Monica Lopez, Anita Johnson, Sabine Blazin, and Vera Tykolsker. I'm Anita Johnson. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.
Howdy, everybody. I'm Rose Maddox, and I'd like to tell you that you're listening to KBOO in Portland, Oregon, the station that I listen to when I'm in the area.
...2018 is coming to a close, and we know that community radio is more important than ever.
You are the number one reason cable exists and can broadcast programming that is not driven by for-profit interests.
KBOO provides a platform for musicians, alternative perspectives, real news, and meaningful programming made by the people, for the people.
We set a big goal to raise $38,000 by the end of the year, and we are proud to announce that we are almost there.
We have just a little while left to finish strong and celebrate a successful 2018.
You know that your voice matters and that KBOO is the resource we need to gather, connect, and make the movement.
Donate today to make sure we meet the $38,000 goal. We are so close and we need you right now.
Go to kboo.fm/give to contribute now.
Support KBOO. Tune in.
And turn up.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934.